Thanks for tuning in for the April 20th podcast. I'm Jose Marino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's feature interview is with Drs. James Dick and Shahar Shelley, and they explore clinical, neurophysiological, and pathological features of patients with chronic immune sensory polyradiculopathy who also have mild motor and distal sensory nerve involvement, the CISP-plus syndrome. For our What's Trending segment, Dr. Benjamin Tolchin discusses the new AAN position statement on ethical issues in clinical research in neurology.
Hi, I'm Ted Burns. I'm from the University of Virginia, and I'm on the phone today with Shahar Shelley and Jim Dick from Mayo Clinic, Minnesota. We are going to discuss their paper, CISP Plus, Expanding the Spectrum of Chronic Immune Sensory Polyradiculopathy. So what I want to do with this interview is discuss two sensory predominant forms of CIDP, CISP and CISP Plus. Jim's group described CISP in 2004, and now the team is describing CISP Plus, and we will discuss both today. So I'm going to start with you, Shahar. What are the typical symptoms of CISP and CISP Plus?
Thank you, Ted. Thank you for having me first. It's a pleasure meeting you virtually. CISP Plus is actually very exciting, as this patient go usually undiagnosed for a long time. In 2004, as you mentioned, our group described the restricted form of sensory CIDP, what they call then chronic immune sensory polyradiculopathy. That's the CISP. That was characterized actually by a selective involvement of sensory nerve roots. These patients clinically presents with sensory loss, gait ataxia, falls, mostly large fiber sensory deficits, which means, I'm sure you all know, reduced vibration and position sense and reduced reflexes, and they all have preserved muscle strength. CISP Plus, additionally, have mild distal muscle weakness.
Okay, Shahar, what about paresthesias or other positive neuropathic sensory symptoms?
Yeah, part of our patient did report neuropathic pain or numbness and tingling, but this was the minority of patients. And when we examined them, we did noted some objective and subjective sensory loss. We used quantitative sensory testing, and we could note some small fiber or thinly myelinated fiber abnormalities, but these were not the main abnormalities in their exam.
Okay, because when I think of CIDP, I think of positive neuropathic sensory symptoms as part of CIDP, and I think I just assumed that CISP would have positive neuropathic sensory symptoms like pins and needles or tingling, but okay, so that's the minority. All right, how often do patients report a definite date of onset?
There are some that came on very insidiously, as much as 20 years, and there isn't a definite onset. And on the other extreme, there was a patient who came on over 3 months from being completely normal to being in a stretcher and unable to move because he was so deafferented. He didn't know where his limbs were in space and he couldn't feed himself and just got subacutely progressively much worse.
Wow. So I often think about positive neuropathic sensory symptoms and definite date or season of onset as being really important clues for acquired, such as immune-mediated or infectious. And that just doesn't hold up here for CISP and CISP Plus, which really would make it tough, a tough diagnosis. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But before we do, Jim, what does the examination look like for these conditions?
Well, as Shahar has pointed out, the patients present with sensory ataxia, and so their symptoms are that they can't walk well and they can't feel well, and their examinations confirm that. They have reduced touch pressure, they have reduced joint position sense, they have reduced vibration, they have absent reflexes, and that's for both CISP and for CISP Plus. For CISP Plus, they also have a little bit of weakness. Now, that weakness tends to be fairly mild. It tends to be distal predominant. So often toe extensors and flexors are a little bit weak. But for both conditions, the real main examination findings are large fiber sensory involvement.
Okay. And could you summarize the nerve conduction studies, typical nerve conduction studies for CISP and CISP Plus?
Yeah, sure. I would be happy to. Nerve conductions are essentially normal in CISP patients. Motor conduction nerves are normal, as well as the sensory conductions. This is actually a very good point, because this is exactly what makes the treating physician, as you mentioned before about the tough diagnosis, think that there is no actual signature of a peripheral nerve process here. But actually, the pathology, as we will talk about, is in the roots that are part of the nervous system. And it's a thought-provoking thing that some patients in our cohort actually were considered hysterical. And if I go way back and think about the index case who had her symptoms, I think more than 15 years when he met her, and she was actually the, I would say, the inspirations to do all the studies that have been done by Michael Schinrich and us, thinking where the pathology could be with the normal nerve conductions.
So similarly, in CISP Plus, I think there's a false localization. So in CISP, the nerve conductions are normal, so it falsely localizes it not to being in the peripheral nervous system, but it really is in the peripheral nervous system. It's confined to the sensory root. In CISP Plus, there are mild abnormalities. The sensory responses are reduced, the motor responses are reduced, but the conduction velocities are not slow. So if anything, it makes one think that this is a nondescript axonal neuropathy, and in fact, it's really a big process going on at the sensory root, and it is falsely localizing to being not a big deal when it is a big deal.
Right, and we should mention, not everybody's learned nerve conduction studies, not every listener has, but the sensory nerve conduction studies are normal on preganglionic sensory nerve injuries, or central, of course, but preganglionic sensory nerve injury. Whereas if it's postganglionic, we expect the sensory nerve conduction studies to be abnormal. So that is why in CISP, which is a preganglionic sensory rootlet problem, the nerve conduction studies are normal. And that is why Jim says they're mildly abnormal in CISP Plus, because there's spillover distally beyond the preganglionic sensory nerve roots. Did I say that okay?
No, I think you did a very nice job of summarizing it. And I think that's exactly the point, is that these are really hard to diagnose conditions, because the typical tools that we use as neurologists kind of let us down. So CISP is a sensory neuropathy, but it's so focally localized to the sensory root level that our normal tools don't tell us. They're normal. The nerve conductions and EMGs are normal. And so you have to go to secondary tests like somatosensory evoked potentials to show slowing in those pathways. And as I said, CISP Plus makes you think there is some abnormality, but it looks more axonal. And so you chalk it up to a nonspecific axonal neuropathy. And really, the process is an inflammatory demyelinating process that is either localized to the sensory root in CISP, or is mostly localized to the sensory root in CISP Plus, with some spillover into the more distal motor fibers and sensory fibers.
You know, as I was reading the paper, I was wondering why you don't simply call CISP Plus a polyradiculoneuropathy and CISP a polyradiculopathy.
Very good point. And you know, you're not the first person who thought that.
I figured.
One of the reviewers made the exact same suggestion.
It wasn't me.
It is almost as if you were the same person.
I wasn't. Or was I? I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't know. But it was a strikingly similar comment. And so it made me wonder whether you might be that reviewer. Course, I wouldn't want to make such an implication. But one of the reviewers asked the exact same question. And I think it's actually a very good question. And so the way I responded to the reviewer, that it was an excellent suggestion. But I'll go back to the bigger condition that we're talking about, which is CIDP, which is chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyradiculoneuropathy.
Right.
And many experts have found that term polyradiculoneuropathy a mouthful and have just shortened it to polyneuropathy. Mm-hmm. And so I think the worry then for me is that if you call one a polyradiculopathy and you call the other a polyradiculoneuropathy, that distinction between them is going to get blurred. And so I think the message is they're very similar. They're really on the same spectrum, but one has a little bit of motor involvement, a little bit of sensory involvement. And I think the term plus does a better job of showing that difference than polyradiculopathy versus polyradiculoneuropathy, although there would be nothing wrong with using your term.
Okay, so as I was reading this paper, I was putting myself back into clinic and I was thinking, if I were to see a patient with a sensory ataxia that I deemed peripheral, maybe it was because of absent reflexes or maybe there were some distal paresthesias, and the patient had mildly abnormal nerve conduction studies, I asked myself, what would stop me from simply sending the routine blood labs, including B12, and then calling it idiopathic when everything came back normal? And the answer I came up with was that the ataxia must seem worse, must seem out of proportion in relation to the mild nerve conduction studies, suggesting again that it was that there's something more going on, something preganglionic in the nerve roots, or of course the central nervous system. So does that seem about right?
I absolutely agree with you. So the whole point is, I think both of these conditions are really hard to pick up and diagnose, and I would never criticize a neurologist who missed these, because these are really tough to pick up. And I even think many neuromuscular people are going to have a difficulty picking these ones up, because they just would fly under the radar, and you're going to think it's sort of an idiopathic ataxic syndrome with a little bit of neuropathy, and you're not going to think further. So I think the real message of this paper is you need to think about these conditions. They need to be on your radar, and you need to be doing other tests to try to pick up on them. And those would include lumbar MRIs to see if you have enlarged, increased signal in your lumbar roots. They would be CSFs to look for elevated CSF proteins. They'd be somatosensory evoked potentials, looking for slowing in the somatosensory pathways. These sorts of things to really focus in on the sensory route being involved.
Just like you mentioned, when you're there in clinic, I think some objective measures, such as absent reflexes, such as severe reduced vibration, and you see these patients usually come. Also, half of our patient came with gait aids. They couldn't walk. Uh-huh. They had to use a cane and a walker. And when you see this, as you mentioned, this out of proportion sensory ataxia and some mild neuropathy on EMG, so exactly like you mentioned, you have to think about something which is proximal to the root. So yeah, it's just a very good point. I wanted to reinforce the fact that neurological examination still is the key to have a suspicion for this disease when you don't have reflexes and severely reduced vibration and position sense.
Yeah, good. Thank you, Shahar. And Jim, could you talk a little bit about the pathology?
Yeah, I think this is a really important question to me, so I'll try to be quick. But when we first saw these patients, we thought this was going to be part of a sensory ganglionopathy, uh-huh, typical of what you see in Sjogren's syndrome. But when we did the rootlet biopsies, we saw onion bulbs, we saw inflammation in the endoneurium of the nerve root. So it really is the pathology of CIDP and inflammatory demyelination. So another really wonderful thing in my mind about this condition is there's amazing clinical correlation, electrophysiologic correlation, and pathological correlation. And what I mean by that is the patients complain of sensory ataxia. When we do the quantitative sensation, we find large fiber involvement and not small fiber involvement. When we do the nerve biopsies, there's loss of large fiber and there's not loss of small fiber. And this really goes along with this is a demyelinating condition. So what does that mean? The large myelinated fibers have the most myelin, so they're going to be the most affected. So thinking from the pathology of this condition, you would predict that large fibers would be predominantly involved, and they are.
That's great. Okay. I mean, that just makes sense. And that's nice to see and nice to hear. Shahar, one of the reasons to make the diagnosis, obviously, is because there are treatments available. And so my question is it treated just like CIDP, or what do we know at this point? And I guess I'm speaking both for CISP and CISP plus.
Yeah, thank you for asking. Actually, response to immunotherapy in both conditions was similar, with marked improvement of their neurological deficits, especially the sensory ataxia. Approximately half of our cohort actually, either the condition returned to be normal with a normal neurological examination, including resolution of the mild weakness in the CIS plus patients. For all patients, the most widely used immunotherapies were IVIG and IV methylprednisolone. And many patients with falls and severe imbalance for years still improved with immunotherapy, suggesting maybe that the treatment is effective even after many years, which is important to note.
So might it be self-limiting in many cases? In other words, the treatment doesn't have to be chronic?
And I think there are several patients in our cohort that are treatment free. But some of them, Jim can also testify, we saw in clinic, still we can't space out IVIG enough to make them feel comfortable with their balance. So I will defer also to Jim. What do you think?
Yeah, no, thank you, Shahar. I completely agree with what both you are saying, in that I think this is very much like other types of CIDP.
Right.
So some CIDP patients, you can wean off immunotherapy and some you can't. Some CISP and CISP plus patients, you get weaned off of immunotherapy and some are dependent on it.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, how do you measure efficacy? What are your outcome measures?
Yeah, this is a tough one. You know, quantitative sensation is quite useful. Examining patients and maybe even doing video exams, measuring how fast people can walk and looking at their video exams before and after treatments are useful ways. But trying to get a sense as is their ataxia better in the history, you know, can patients do things now that they couldn't do before? And as Shahar has pointed out, a lot of them, it makes a huge difference to them.
Yeah. Okay. Good point. And I've learned a lot from today's discussion and from the paper. Again, I've been speaking with Shahar Shelley and Jim Dick from Mayo about the paper CISP Plus Expanding the Spectrum of Chronic Immune Sensory Polyradiculopathy. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Ted.
Thank you, Ted.
This is David Lapidus at the University of Virginia. Today, I'm joined by Ben Tolchin. He's an assistant professor of neurology at Yale and co-chair of the ethics committee at the Yale New Haven Hospital. He's here to talk to us about the American Academy of Neurology position statement, Ethical Issues in Clinical Research in Neurology, published in March of 2020. Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Dave. Thanks. It's a real honor. I'm a big fan of the Neurology Podcast and the Neurology Minute as a great educational device. Thank you.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, thank you for being our guest here today. So can you just give us a very brief understanding of what was the motivation behind the updates here?
Sure. Yeah. So the last position statement on clinical research ethics from the AAN and the American Neurologic Association and the Child Neurology Society came out back in 1998. And the feeling within those groups was that there had been very significant scientific and technological advances between 1998 and the present time, and that the position statement was becoming dated due to those developments.
Wonderful. And we really want to keep this very clinically relevant to the practicing neurologist. So the structure of the interview, we were hoping to just march through a couple of different topics and make sure that our clinical neurologists have the most up-to-speed ideas of what the position statement contains. So starting with genetics, as you mentioned, we've come a long way since 1998. So can you tell us a bit about the updates regarding genetics and specifically how that's related to what are called actionable results in testing?
Sure, yeah. So I think some of the biggest scientific advances in genetic testing have to do with whole exome and whole genome testing, which is now not just feasible, but is actually affordable for use in clinical practice and is widespread in clinical research. So one of the issues that comes up with whole exome and whole genome testing is that there are incidental findings of genetic variations that cause disease or are likely to cause disease. And within those incidental findings, there's a subset that are actionable, which means that there are medical interventions available that can avert or ameliorate the disease that those genetic variations cause. And so, like, you know, a common example of this would be BRCA1 and BRCA2, which can lead to breast cancer, for example, and which can be addressed, the risk can be ameliorated through, for example, mastectomy. It's been found that about 2% of healthy participants will just incidentally have actionable findings when they undergo whole exome testing. So this is something that comes up in any research study and also any clinical use of whole exome testing. And, you know, right now, the many research studies will not share any genetic information that is incidentally found during the study. And, you know, that can be problematic. So there's an ethical principle of informed consent, which suggests that participants in a research study and also patients undergoing whole exome testing for clinical purposes should be informed upfront of, you know, possible foreseeable consequences, such as actionable genetic findings. And they should be given the choice ahead of time about whether they would want to be informed of these actionable findings. And so that's one of the recommendations in our position statement.
Wonderful. I think that's a really thorough explanation and really, again, relevant for those of us who are occasionally ordering whole exome sequencing if our more targeted testing is not necessarily yielding the results that we're looking for. And moving on to the next issue, there's a concept called the replication crisis. And I'd love to hear your explanation of that and how exactly the new guidelines address it.
Sure. So the replication crisis is an increasingly recognized phenomenon where peer-reviewed and widely cited studies that demonstrate statistically significant results can't be reproduced by other researchers. You know, this gets by far the most attention in the psychological literature, where this has been a really significant problem, but it's also been occurring in neurologic clinical research as well. And the recent replication efforts have gone to really great lengths to get the review and approval of the scientists who conducted the original studies. They've used larger sample sizes than the original studies did, and yet they have been able to reproduce less than half of the replicated studies. They've been able to find the results that were demonstrated in the original studies in less than half of the cases. And so obviously that is very troubling. From an ethical perspective, we would say that, you know, this undermines the scientific validity of the research and also the social value of the research, because if the research is not consistently reproducible, then those results can't be relied on to guide future clinical decisions. And so, you know, there are a number of ways to address this that the AAN position statement has recommended. So one issue is the pre-registration of studies with clinicaltrials.gov. Another recommendation is to, whenever possible, share the study protocols, statistical analyses, the data, and the results in publicly accessible repositories. There are repositories like the Open Science Framework or the Registry of Research Data Repositories. The AAN, in this position statement, also recommended the use of checklists for reporting studies. The examples of these checklists include the CONSORT checklist for clinical trials and the STROBE checklist for observational studies. And the position statement also recommended that not only p-values should be reported in studies, but also these should be supplemented with measures of effect size or association and measures of uncertainty, such as 95% confidence intervals. And the AAN position statement also recommended that replication studies of previously published research should be funded and published. And you know, I think these recommendations are important not just for researchers, but also for the general neurologist and other consumers of research. So you know, when a general neurologist is reading and interpreting a study, I think it's important to ascertain whether the study was pre-registered, whether measures of effect size or association are reported, whether measures of uncertainty are reported, and to take that into account when you're interpreting a clinical research document.
Wonderful and really thorough and helpful. And I do hope that those research funds do get funneled towards some of this replication, because I know that's a frustrating aspect of many of these smaller studies. Next, I want to talk about another curious concept called the therapeutic misconception. And so can you first tell us a little bit about what that is and then how we should think about it in the context of enrolling patients in clinical trials? As I know, many people are associated with different centers and always trying to get folks involved or engaged in clinical research, and many patients themselves are seeking that out specifically.
Sure. Thanks, Dave. That's a really important question. So the therapeutic misconception is the false belief that the primary goal of clinical research is the benefit of the study participants or current patients. And in fact, the primary goal of clinical research is the development of generalizable knowledge to benefit future patients. And you know, the failure to appreciate that difference, it's kind of a failure to appreciate the difference between clinical care, where the almost the exclusive goal is the benefit of the individual patient, versus clinical research, where the focus is much more on generating this generalizable knowledge for the benefit of future patients. And that's, you know, really important because there's this ethical principle of informed consent. So patients should be educated and notified of the nature of the project that they're going to be involved in if they are considering getting involved in clinical research and the purpose of that. And you know, if the patient or especially the researcher or the clinician is believing that the primary goal is the benefit of the current participants, the current patients, that is going to undermine the informed consent process. So I think it's very important for researchers, clinicians, and patients to be aware from the point where patients are starting to get referred to a research study, even before they're enrolled, that the purpose of the research study is going to be to learn about an intervention, not to provide a known beneficial intervention to the patient. I think that's a very important distinction to make. And you know, we may have reason, we may hope that the intervention will be beneficial for the current participants. We may even have evidence that suggests that it might be beneficial, you know, perhaps animal studies or prior human safety studies, but we don't have conclusive evidence that the intervention is beneficial for the current participants. If we did have that evidence, it would be unethical to do a study. We should be doing that intervention as part of routine clinical care.
That last point's really helpful, and I think it's really important for all of us to be making sure to counsel our patients appropriately when they are making these requests. Aren't there any clinical trials going on? And I think this can really help further contextualize that conversation. So, Ben, I really appreciate you coming to join us today to discuss the position statement, Ethical Issues in Clinical Research in Neurology, which again was published in March of 2020. It's available online, and I really encourage our listeners to take a look, and they can learn a significant amount more about these topics where Ben and his group has undertaken a deep exploration of each of these topics. So, Ben, thank you so much again for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was an honor to participate.
Thanks again.
This is Jose Marino. Don't forget to check out Neurology's three subspecialty journals, Neurology Genetics, Neurology, Neuroimmunology and Inflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice, as well as our mini-sites on Equity, Diversity and Inclusion, Global Neurology, and Innovations in Care Delivery. Please check out this week's journal, which features an article that describes the impact of COVID-19 among patients with myasthenia gravis, as well as a study examining the clinical characteristics, management, and outcome of neurological adverse events of immune checkpoint inhibitors. Please take a look at this and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.